We're going to be looking at Exodus chapter 19. So if you can turn that chapter up in your Bibles, that would be good. I'll just read from verse 3. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak to the people of Israel." It was an exciting chapter that we read, wasn't it? Can you imagine if we had the opportunity to meet up with an Israelite who had been there in Exodus chapter 19 and compared notes about what it was like to go to church? You might think, well, he is going to be somewhat underwhelmed as we describe our experience of going to church. Here's a person who, however good our musicians are, and they are excellent, he can tell us about heaven's trumpets sounding. And Roz, there wasn't any volume control on those trumpets in Exodus chapter 15. They were loud. And he can talk about the whole granite bulk, 2,500 meters of Sinai, actually shaking as God descended on the mountain, and fire and thunder and thick cloud. The voice of God was actually heard here on earth. It's awesome. And yet, as he's telling you this, and then you are trying to tell him about, you know, what it's like at Abbey Hall. I mean, the view's quite nice. And there's this man who stands at the front, and he opens up a book, and he reads from the book. And then we pray to God, and we sing songs. It's actually the Israelite from Exodus 19 whose eyes are standing out on stalks, whose mouth is agog, because he can hardly believe the privileges that you have. And the experiences that he went through in Exodus 19 are nothing compared with the privileges, the gospel privileges that you have today. And I want you to treasure those things. And as we come to chapter 19, again, it's a chapter which is pointing us on to the wonders of the gospel. It's a chapter that starts with a chronological marker. That's important. On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain while Moses went up to God. We've got their setting out and we've got their arrival, the beginning and the end of a journey. That's what the chronological marker is doing for us. And it might surprise us, because we thought that the journey was a journey that was going to begin in slavery in Egypt and the Passover and the Exodus, and it was going to end where? In Canaan, in the Promised Land. Well, of course, it does eventually, but the great journey was always to come here to Sinai, to meet with God and to worship God. Do you remember how months ago now, when we were starting this series out, God says to Moses, you're going to bring my people out of Egypt, and I'm going to go with you, and the sign that I'll be with you is that you'll bring that people to this mountain, and you will worship me here. And every time they've gone to Pharaoh, it has been that we might go into the wilderness to meet our God, and to worship God. So they can't come to Canaan and the eventual home without first coming to meet God in the wilderness. And it's true for all of us. The most important journey that you and I can go on is the journey to come and encounter God in faith and peace. And without encountering him in the todays of our wilderness journey, we will not get to the tomorrow of heaven. If we don't come and meet God now, we will not get to what Canaan ultimately points to, which is the new heavens and the new earth. So this journey is a journey in itself. It's so important. In Exodus, they have been brought out of slavery to meet God. And what happens at Sinai is so important that the rest of the book of Exodus is going to take place on this mountain or under the shadow of this mountain. But we're also moving into a whole new section of Exodus where God tells his people what he wants from them. He is now going to give them his law, his Torah, his direction for their lives. But it's wonderful that the Lord doesn't tell his people what they are to do until halfway through the book. You notice that? It's chapter 20 when finally the law arrives, not chapter 1 where God says you're going to do this. And the first half of the book of Exodus has not been what we do for God. The first half has been what God does for us. About how God delivers his people, first of all. And then he puts demands on our lives. So first God shows what he does for his people, and then what he requires from his people. First the gospel, then the instruction for our lives. This is the only way. It's the biblical way. Everywhere you go, first grace, then instruction. And in case we've missed it, it's again carved into the pages of chapter 19. So first we've got the gospel pattern, verse 3. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. As God goes up into the mountain the first time, and there are three ascents and descents of Mount Sinai. It's a pretty big mountain. That's just in chapter 19. There'll be seven in Exodus. His Fitbit would be telling him he'd done really, really well. He certainly did his 10,000 steps in Exodus 19. But as he goes up the first time into the mountain, God restates and further embellishes the covenant to him, gives him these great promises. And there are three parts to this first point. First of all, what God has done. They know what I did to the Egyptians. They know that I'm the God who has come and I've redeemed my people. I've come and I've saved them. And we've seen over recent weeks and months how God had heard the groaning of his people, seen their sadness, the way that they were mistreated. And that wonderful moment in chapter 2, verse 24, God says, I remember my covenant. I remember that they're mine. And God had acted. The fact that his people were held as slaves by the greatest superpower of the ancient world, it is not a problem to a God who can say that all the earth is mine. And having asked nicely first that Pharaoh should let his people go, and been met by ridicule from Pharaoh, who is Yahweh that I should obey him? The Lord has said, okay, let me introduce myself to you. And God, step by step, systematically, has not just taken on, but taken apart Egypt and Pharaoh. God by God, he's taken on their pantheon and shown that they've got nothing that they can trust in. They're helpless and hopeless before him. And this great power is defeated. And that's only a dry run for the Lord. You've got to keep reminding yourself of that when we're going through Exodus. The greatest superpower of the ancient world was a tiny little enemy compared with the big enemies that God had in his sights. When it wasn't the dry run, when it was the real thing, it was going to be Satan he was bringing down. And death, and the grave, and sin, and guilt. But God took the enemies of his people apart, and then he look at these words, he carried his people. I bore you on eagle's wings. And he did, didn't he? God picked them up and he carried them through those plague days, and God covered them on that great day of judgment, the last plague. And God carried them through the Red Sea, and he's carried them through the wilderness. And he hasn't just carried them anywhere. Did you see where he's carried them? I bore you on eagle's wings, and I brought you to myself because you belong to me. Because I made a covenant with your forefather Abraham that in your family I would bring a blessing to the whole earth. And I keep that covenant. I love you, he's saying to them, because I love you. And I will be your God. This is your God speaking. If he is your God, I carry you on eagle's wings. Fear not, for I've redeemed you. I've called you by name. You are mine. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flames shall not consume you. This is your God. I carry you on eagle's wings to myself. I've moved heaven and earth to bring you here to the mountain. And so, second heading under the first point, having said what God has done for his people, it is only right, isn't it, that God can now make a demand on his people. If you will indeed obey my voice and will keep my command, keep my covenant. Does that seem onerous to you? That a God who has done so much for his people should not be so loved by his people that they would want to get closer and closer to that God and obey that God and walk with that God. Doesn't love so amazing, so divine, not only demand my soul, my life, my all, but also excite my soul and life and all to be closer to him and to know him better and enjoy him more? Because the third point heading under this first point is that God has more to give. God unwraps the covenant blessings for his obedient, faithful people. And you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Think about those words, a kingdom of priests. God is holding out as the goal of the covenant the priesthood of all believers. Every one of his people with a right to come into his presence, to look into his face and say, Abba, Father. A right to, if you like, come up the mountain and sit down with him. God is promising access here, full, unfettered access to him. And he calls them his treasured possession amongst all the earth. We're thinking, is he being serious here or sarcastic? How could we be the special treasured possession that God owns? I mean, look at what God has made and what God owns. He's made the mountain ranges. He's made the oceans. He's the God who has put the beauty and the colour and the intricacy into creation. He's the God who paints those sunsets over there. 11 years after moving down onto the south coast, I still go and watch the sunset from time to time. Because it's amazing. You know, you who were born in Southampton, you don't know what you're taking for granted. And I look at it, and I think, slow down, Lord. You've just invented a new colour. You've painted a masterpiece on that vast western canvas. And God is, oh, it's okay. I'll do another one tomorrow. And then as the sun sets, he unravels the night sky, and there's God's glory shining out in stars and planets and constellations and galaxies and nebula. And God beckons to angels and archangels, and he says to them, "Do you really want to see the ultimate treasure that I've got?" And he opens up his hands, and it's you. His church. His beloved people. Yes, the Old Testament church here, but the words that he applies to the Old Testament church in Exodus 19, he applies to the New Testament church in 1 Peter chapter 2. To all believing Jews and Gentiles, all the family of faith. Isn't that lovely? My most valuable treasure. And God says, it's you. We're only 1.5 books into the Bible at this point, and we're already standing literally and spiritually on mountaintops as God is unfolding the covenant to his people. And yet, secondly, there's a problem, isn't there? Because for all the wonderful promises of the gospel, as we go through Exodus 19, God and the people seem poles apart. A great gulf exists between them. This is a chapter that's shouting out the holiness of God, and God hasn't changed. Your God is still the God who came down on Sinai. And it's also shouting out the unholiness of the people. And the problem is sin. Can they really keep covenant with God? Moses hears the wonderful words on the top of the mountain. He hurries down the mountain. He tells the elders and the people all of the words that God has given them. And the people say, "Oh yeah, we can do that. Yeah, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. No problems." You're thinking, are you sure? For a start, you haven't heard what God has said yet. And God, I know because I've read on, is going to say you are to be holy as I am holy. And you're to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength, and your neighbour as yourself. And that you lot, I've been watching you through these chapters, you've been grumbling and complaining and blaspheming and doubting your way through the wilderness for these past 3 months. You've been on the verge of apostasy in every chapter we've come to. In a couple of chapters' time, you're going to abandon God and you're going to start worshipping your new favourite idol, the golden calf. The covenant is going to be completely smashed. And here you are saying, "Oh yeah, we can keep the covenant, no problems." We know about these people because we've identified with them. We've said that they remind us of us time and time again. And yet, like us checking a box to agree to the terms and the conditions that you never read, do you? Because when you turn them up, they're like a slightly abridged version of War and Peace. And all you wanted was the Tesco Club Card app. And so you just say, yeah, I agree. Well, here they are, and it's a matter of life and death. And they say, yes, yeah, we can do that. Well, Moses hurries up the mountain and he tells God, the people, they say yes. And God sends him back down again with instructions that suggest that all is not quite as simple as maybe Israel thought. They are, verse 10, to consecrate themselves first for 2 days. That means to set themselves apart as clean. They're to wash their garments as an outward sign that they are clean. Yet the fact that they're to make an effort to make themselves clean tells you that they're not clean in the first place. And however sparkly their Sabbath best newly washed clothes are, they're hiding a dirty interior. And the problem is highlighted as now Yahweh sets limits and boundaries on the mountain and issues dire warnings Verse 12, you shall set limits for the people all around. Take care not to go up on the mountain or even touch the edge of it. And we're realizing that Sinai is not a safe place to be. It's a place of restricted access. The temple becomes a picture, really, of what we see at Sinai. The tabernacle is a picture of the restricted access that you've got at the mountain, where God is having to say, stand back. In fact, it all goes back to Eden, where they had initially walked with God, which is what we were created to do, and then we'd sinned against God, and we'd been driven out of the presence of God. There was no access now back to God. And access here is restricted. It's a place of restricted revelation. The Lord wraps himself, verse 9, in thick cloud to protect the people. Because the very thing that he wants to give to us, which is himself, and the very thing that we were created for, to walk with God and love God and know God and have fellowship with God, at this point will consume us. Because God is consuming fire. God is unapproachable light, and God will burn against anything that is evil. And Moses, who has just ascended the mountain the third time in this chapter, is sent straight back down again to re-emphasize the warnings. Verse 21, go down, warn the people, lest they break through to look at the Lord, and many of them perish. And it's a great sense of anticlimax. All these promises. I've done all this work. I've carried you on eagle's wings. I've brought you to myself. And Moses leads the people, it says in the chapter, out to meet God. And they just never do meet God, do they? All this activity. And yet, we arrive at Sinai for this great meeting with God, which really isn't. Because legally and spatially, we're still as far apart as ever. Is this the best that God could do? He had great plans, made great promises, but this is as close as he can bring us to him. To stand at the bottom of the mountain and look up at cloud and fire. Sure, people are still being saved in Exodus because that's what God had promised to do. They're still going to heaven if they trust him. But at this point, God is saving his people on credit. And he is running up an enormous bill. Something has to happen. And finally, thirdly, we've got the gospel provision. God goes on unveiling the wonder and the glory of the covenant to save the world. He never ever rows back on a single promise. God doesn't say, well, I said too much. I shouldn't have said as much then. No, God simply says more and more and more as you go through the Old Testament. And he puts provisions in place for this sinful people at Sinai. He gives them sacrifices to teach them of the awfulness of sin and the terrible cost of forgiveness. He gives them a priesthood, because far from being a kingdom of priests at this point, they need a priest, a high priest, to go and represent them. Access is still restricted. As you go through the next great big section of this book, kings come and go. Centuries roll on. Empires, world empires, rise and fall. And people will get plucked from the land. A remnant will return. They'll return to 500 years of silence from God. And yet the faithful had the covenant promises of God, who can't lie. And suddenly, on an actual day in history, a day that God describes as the day when the time was right, God acted finally and decisively. And there were no more pictures, no more shadows. Now it was the real thing. And God came down in our midst, not on a mountain, wrapping himself in cloud, but in flesh, as a brother. God came down as a child who's born, a son who was given. And God humbled himself as a slave. And John could say, we saw his glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father. And it was full of grace and truth. And in our humanity, as our brother, Jesus, the great I Am of Exodus, the God of light and fire, he in our humanity lives the life that we couldn't live. He keeps the covenant for us. And having lived a perfect life that the Father has described as flawless, he takes that life of law-keeping. And as we sang in that second hymn, he flings it round our shoulders like a robe of righteousness. This is yours. I didn't live that life to show you how to do it. Because you're like the Israelites in Exodus 19. You can't do it by yourselves. I did it for you. And you say, what does he want in exchange? He's going to take everything, isn't he? Well, yes, he's going to take everything that we were. In exchange for that righteousness, he takes all of our sin and our guilt, everything that has caused God's wrath to fall on this world, he takes onto his shoulders. And he carries those sins, not to Sinai, but into the darkness and the fire and the storm and the earthquake of Calvary, where your Lord represents you before the judgment seat of God and clears all your debts through his death on the cross. And as he dies, he shouts, I've done it. It's finished. In that very moment, the temple veil that said, don't come in. The temple veil that was the picture of what was taking place on the mountain, the fence around the mountain, which was the picture of the cherubim standing at the gates to Eden. In fact, it had the cherubim woven into that veil. That veil was just torn into. Because God was no longer saying, don't break through. God was saying, because of Jesus, I want you to come in. You can come home to me. We got that lovely expression in Exodus 19, born on eagle's wings to God. But the reality is just so much better, isn't it? We're carried by the Son to the Father. Do you remember he told that story of the shepherd who lost one of his sheep, and he went out into the wilderness and he found the sheep, and he didn't drag it home by the ear. He picked it up and put it on his shoulders, and he brought that sheep home. That's what Jesus did for you. Came into this dark, lost, cursed world to find you and to save you and carry you home. Because of that, we really have access to our Abba Father through Jesus. If we could bring in our friend from chapter 19 again, and we could have read that passage from Hebrews 12 together, he would have been amazed. We'd have read, for you've not come to that which can be touched, blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further message be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. And the Israelite would have said, I remember it well. But we go on. But you've come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in festal gathering. They haven't got armor on anymore, he's saying. The swords have been put away. They're having a celebration. To innumerable angels in festal gathering, to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. Those are the names of the church written there. Your name, if you believe in Jesus. To the assembly of the firstborn enrolled in heaven, to God, the judge of all. And beside him, look, the spirits of righteous people made perfect. How is God, the judge of all, able to be with these people who are now declared perfect in his sight? Well, because there at the very center of all things is Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. And to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Now, won't we love such a Lord as that? Won't we just adore a God who has done all that for us? Won't we? Wake up, Netley. And won't we show our love for a God who has done that for us by wanting to keep his commandments? That's what Jesus said. He said, whoever has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and show more of myself to him. It's Exodus 19 again. I do this for you. You love me and you keep my commandments, and I just take you deeper and deeper and deeper into the covenant of God, so that you can say, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, but you're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, now you are the people of God. Once you'd not obtained mercy, now you have obtained mercy. That's you if you're trusting in Jesus. And it can be you if you'll turn to him in faith and call on him for mercy now. And say, Lord, I can't save myself. I can't use the law to climb up to you, but you can save me. And if you gave yourself for me, then I give myself to you, and I'm yours. And by your grace, I will follow you. I know I'll fail, but I know you won't fail. And you'll keep picking me up. And by your grace, I will walk with you all the way home. Or make today to be the beginning of that great journey where you walk with God to the end of time, and then into eternity.